Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, your hair looks great today.
Thanks, Robert.
You're welcome.
It's a ponytail, so. Well,
you know, you had to take last week off to get your hair done, and I tried to make fun of you, and all of our guests yelled at me.
They know what it's like.
They do. They know what it's like. But you're back here this week, and we're going to have a great show today. We have today have Guthrie Graves Fitzsimmons joining us today to talk about Bernie Sanders and Tom Perez, who visited Louisville last week. We are going to talk to Jasmine about the judicial branch in the state of Kentucky's government. And we have a segment I am entitling Better Know Your Governor, because we know a little bit more about our governor recently than we did in the past, and we'll get to that shortly. But let's go ahead and get started with Guthrie. Guthrie Graves Fitzsimmons is Guthrie Graves Fitzsimmons is a writer and organizer in Louisville, where he has been published in the Courier Journal, the Washington Post, and Religion News Service. He went to the event yesterday at the Louisville Palace featuring Bernie Sanders and Tom Perez, and he is here to talk to us about it today. Guthrie, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, we're very excited to have you. We recently featured Michael Powell, who's actually sitting in the other room. You may hear him in the background at some point, who talked to us about the Trump visit to Louisville. And, it got a lot of good reviews. So you're going to be competing with him. You may not know him, but you're going to talk to us about the Bernie Sanders and Tom Perez visit to Louisville. So first of all, tell us about the crowd.
The crowd was packed. It was my first time actually in Louisville Palace, which was a great venue.
It's an awesome venue. It's so cool.
Beautiful venue. I'm looking forward to seeing Idina Menzel there in August.
Awesome.
But this was a great warm-up act for Idina.
Yeah, for sure.
I think she's going to have a tough time topping it, because the crowd, you could feel it, was so excited. People had their Bernie shirts on. I think that they'd been like in mourning since he lost the primary. And you could tell it was at capacity. I know there was still a line outside. From the moment I was in the theater, there was a great buzz that was building. And then there was a bluegrass band that was opening for them.
Cool.
And I've been to a lot of Democratic rallies in my life. A lot of just speech after speech of people going on and on forever about their pet causes. This was a tightly scripted, smartly organized event with Allison Lunder and Grimes and Congressman John Yarmuth opening. And then the main event, Tom Perez and Bernie Sanders, and they both gave great speeches.
Oh, man. That actually makes me kind of wish I'd have been there, because my main criticism most of the time of these kind of events is like, I don't want to go because of a bunch of terrible people who I don't care about and usually like one person who I want to see. But that sounds kind of cool. Okay, so that actually answered one of my questions, which was like, was it people that were like hardcore supporters or people that were just there to kind of check it out? Sounds like hardcore supporters, right?
It was the Bernie-crats, from what I could tell. And me, probably the lone person who voted for Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary in the corner, being like, it's nice to see you friends again. It was a lot of Bernie people. They introduced both speakers and they were like, Tom Perez. And everyone was quiet. I don't think they knew who Tom Perez was when he walked into the room, or they'd heard negative things about him,
right,
from him being the Clinton choice for the chair of the Democratic Party. And so everyone was there for Bernie, it seemed like.
Yeah. Okay, so just to contextualize this a little bit for our Kentucky-based audience, and that's that Tom Perez is the chair of the Democratic National Convention. The Democratic National Convention exists to elect Democrats to the presidency. And Tom Perez ran against Keith Ellison, who is a congressperson from Minnesota, and had backed Bernie Sanders in the primary, whereas Tom Perez had backed Hillary Clinton. And so when Tom Perez won, I believe there were a lot of people who had supported Bernie who were a little disappointed. And I think, is that kind of the gist of this whole kind of event?
The event was billed as come together, fight back.
But
the emphasis was definitely on come together. There was some brief heckling of Tom Perez as he came on, some boos, and some people were trying. I think it was just one gentleman who was trying to yell at him. But he was hellbent on coming out and just giving a fiery speech that I think, as people got used to it, was received very well by the audience.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. So Tom Perez started kind of slowly because people were booing him, but by the end, people were into it.
Definitely. He gave a profanity-laced speech, which I found interesting. He said, Speaker Paul Ryan and Donald Trump proposed a skinny budget in Congress, but I call it a shitty budget. And I think people were surprised a little bit about a couple times he said shit, and I don't think he used the F word. But he
are
was,
we going to bleep this?
Well, I don't know. It's in the news context. It's kind of like when the New York Times had the F word on their headline. Like
Just reporting about what was said last night.
It wasn't like you, Jasmine.
I was kind of looking around like, are there children here? And I think his idea is to come in and really, he said the resistance over and over again, which is strange. This is a Democratic Party, which in my lifetime has not been the resistance. And I think he was really trying to tap into the grassroots anger. Senator Sanders, meanwhile, who of course is not a Democrat, but ran as a Democrat for president, only mentioned the Democratic Party to say that he wanted to reform it and make it more anti-establishment and more anti-Wall Street, which of course were his critiques of Hillary Clinton during the primary. It was strange in that way that they were trying to come together, but there was obviously still some tension in the room.
So that makes a lot of sense to me from a national standpoint. Like, that kind of goes right in line with kind of like what I expected to happen from that. I'm very curious, though, to hear how Allison Lindergan Grimes and John Yarmuth were received. So we're a Kentucky-based podcast about Kentucky politics. I'm interested to hear how the Kentucky people were received by this audience.
Secretary of State Grimes, I think, gave a charismatic speech with some great applause lines. And it was kind of devoid of policy specifics, it seemed, though.
That fits what I think about her sometimes, is pretty devoid of policy specifics.
The person I was with referred to it as she was the Hillary Clinton of Kentucky. And I think that in this crowd was not received as a compliment.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Congressman Yarmuth gave a really well-received speech. And he kind of said offhand, and I'm for single-payer health care. And the whole crowd erupted in a standing ovation on that line. And so I think people want the policy specifics. They don't want necessarily the most charismatic speech, but they want to know what their legislators are doing, what they stand for. Mm-hmm. And so he gave no big lead up, no grand rhetoric. He just said, I'm for single payer. And that's what people responded to.
Right. That's interesting. And I think Kentucky Democrats are really excited about John Yarmuth at all times, especially the more liberal ones who would go to a Bernie Sanders speech. And Allison Lindergan Grimes is somebody who, she's tried to ride the line and get the old school Democrats to support her, while at the same time trying to maintain some cachet with the more progressive people. So that's one of the reasons she does things like doesn't say who she voted for in the presidential election.
And she did that commercial where she's like shooting a gun and talking to the
So she'll do that kind of stuff too. So So that's interesting.
I don't think she did anything to tap into the grassroots resistance energy in the room.
I saw some pictures of like Rocky Adkins there on the front row, and I was kind of, I don't know. I wonder if I really am interested to hear what they think about it. They probably won't ever tell me. But yeah, some of the older school Kentucky Democrats were there as well. So you talked about single payer as something that John Yarmuth had mentioned as something that really got everybody going. And that actually heartens me that people are interested to hear about policy. So from any of the four speakers, were there any elements of policy besides single payer that really resonated with people?
I think stopping Trump was the refrain that was most exciting, which I think is several different policy issues. The one that Bernie Sanders started with was talking about Muhammad Ali and wanting to stop the Muslim ban.
Right.
But speaker after speaker said that it was important to tie Trump's policies to the Republican Party, and that Trump had promised to be this different kind of Republican that was going to do infrastructure spending and break with the Republican kind of tax breaks for the rich and trickle down economics. And they were saying that his actual presidency was reflective of his embracing the Republican Party, especially on economics.
Interesting. But that's good to know. So the Democrats were trying to tie Donald Trump's rhetoric and kind of his more inflammatory statements to the Republican Party, which, I mean, shouldn't be too hard because he's a Republican president of the United States. He sets the agenda for the Republican Party, ostensibly.
There was also a lot of talk about how he was anti-organized labor and tying Donald Trump's rhetoric on labor with Matt Bevin's embrace of right to work. President Trump has actually very much tried to do outreach to organized labor, especially more of the kind of like building trades folks.
Right.
And so I think trying to really, there was a union member who spoke, I think introducing Tom Perez, And so there was a really strong embrace of union organizing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that actually leads me to my next question, which is, do you get a sense of why big national speakers like Tom Perez, the chairman of the DNC, and Bernie Sanders, the guy who came in second for the Democratic nomination for president, what the heck are they doing in Louisville, Kentucky, especially on a day when there was, you know, a special election in Georgia for a House seat?
Senator Sanders addressed this head on. He said the Democratic Party can't be the party of just the East Coast and the West Coast. They're making a point to go out to communities between the traditional power centers of California and New York and really make a pitch for what Democratic values are, and that people can't write off voters in the middle of the country to the Republican Party. In addition to talking about Muhammad Ali and the Muslim ban, Senator Sanders started off by talking about Woody Guthrie, who's very close to my heart. I was named after him. And his song, Which Side Are You On?, which is about Harlan County and the mine workers' strike there, that this is a moment for the country to decide which side are we on? Are we with Trump or are we against him? And immediately, there's been a big debate kind of nationally about, are the Democrats going to listen to more to working class and rural whites or diverse cities on the coast? And Bernie Sanders just came out right from the beginning and was like, we're going to talk about mine workers, we're going to talk about union rights, and we're going to talk about our diverse cities and religious and ethnic diversity. And so I think they're making the case that they're going to do both and are traveling all across the country to make that case.
All right. So to sum up, do you think that the purported idea here to kind of tie the Bernie wing of the party, of the Democratic Party, back to, you know, the rest of the Democratic Party, do you feel like this event was helpful in that end?
You might have to ask someone who was a Bernie-crat or a Bernie supporter. I left, in terms of coming from someone who supported Hillary Clinton in the primary, I felt very unified and very encouraged by what I saw. I saw them take a very strong stand together. And I think it reflects the work that Hillary and Bernie did during the general election to try to bring the two factions together. And this only furthers that.
All right. All right. Well, you're welcome to hang around, or you're free to go. Either one you want to do.
I'll stay and listen.
Oh, cool. All right, Jasmine. We recently, before the legislative session started, we talked a lot about the legislature. I actually ended up naming all the committees and it took forever, but I thought it was useful. So I just sped
I had other people tell me that that was really useful to them and that they really liked that episode.
Okay.
So
well, good. Well, we're doing something similar this time. You're going to tell us all about the judicial branch.
I am.
Of the Kentucky government. So Jasmine, tell us everything we need to know about Kentucky courts.
Okay. So I'm kind of starting with bottom to top. So first is the district court. So the district court level, they handle juvenile court matters, city and county ordinances, misdemeanors, violations, traffic offenses, probate court, felony probable cause hearings, small claims, and civil cases involving less than $5,000 or less. Most of what happens here are, you know, small claims type things and criminal misdemeanor court, but probate and all of those other things as well. Felony cases actually start in district court too, unless they are direct indicted. Do you know what that means?
Not a single clue.
A felony case will start in district court and it may be resolved there. If it is a lower class of felony, it could be resolved as a misdemeanor or something like that. If it's not resolved in district court, a person is entitled to a probable cause hearing. If probable cause is found for the felony charge, the case gets sent to the grand jury. A grand jury, they hear some proof about the case from a prosecutor and probably a police officer or detective, and they make a finding. If there's probable cause for the charge, they get indicted by the grand jury, and then their case starts in circuit court.
Gotcha.
So felony cases start in district court unless direct indicted, and a direct indictment may happen in a case that's more serious. So, for example, Officer Rodman, the police officer who was killed a few weeks ago, the person who is charged with his murder, that case was direct indicted. It did not start in district court. It went straight to circuit court.
So a lot of like stuff, if somebody is kind of...
A lot of stuff happens in district court.
It's so, like if somebody shows up and they're like, I got to go to court, they probably mean district court if they're not like already in jail.
Possibly.
Oh, no. Okay.
But like, right, like your traffic tickets, your driving without insurance, juvenile court, you know, all of that stuff, that's all district court. District court judges are elected judges, and they are elected to 4-year terms.
All right. Okay, now that's interesting. So Kentucky does have elected judges, which I know because I voted in here. And I'm
right.
I think the common thing about voting for judges in the state is like, I have no idea what's going on most of the time. Like, what
exactly.
These people
are doing. And it's hard to find out. It's even hard to find out, you know, online. You don't get a lot of information about the judges. Those elections used to be partisan until 1976. Now they are nonpartisan, or supposed to be, but, you know, they sometimes turn political. And I think that that brings up a larger point about elected versus appointed judges. So appointed judges are appointed by a nominating commission, and those are supposed to be bipartisan. So This is like merit-based appointments.
Gotcha.
Some states do appoint judges. We are an election state.
Mm-hmm.
Elected judges, you know, that they say this is supposed to be more democratic. This is the most democratic way to do it. But it really oftentimes comes down to money.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to families that are well-known in the county who have family members who are judges or big-time attorneys, and a lot of special interest money. And I think it also results in judges making rulings to please the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times they want to seem tough on crime. Cases that are very public, they want to make a ruling that will, you know, appease the people that are voting for them. And sometimes I think it can result in less qualified judges as well.
Yeah. Well, my go-to strategy when it comes to electing judges is to lean very hard on my lawyer friends.
Right. I get a lot of texts from people when it gets like a couple days before the election.
So I would say to all of you people out there, when it comes to voting for judges, ask your lawyer friends. And if you have no lawyer friends, ask Jasmine.
And there is a group called the Citizens for Better Judges, and you can usually look to them, at least in Louisville.
Sure.
For maybe an idea of who you might want to vote for as well. But you're right. It's hard to find out information. They're supposed to be nonpartisan, so you don't really get a lot of information about issues because it's not supposed to be about issues.
Right.
So district court judges elected to 4-year terms. We obviously have the greatest number of district court judges than any kind, because that's where all the stuff seems to happen.
Yeah, all the stuff is at district court, and there's the most of them. That makes
right.
sense.
And there's just people sitting around everywhere waiting on attorneys, and police officers standing around everywhere. It's kind of a mess.
Like, sounds like a mess, yeah.
So next up is circuit court. So circuit courts hear felony cases that have been indicted by the grand jury. They have original jurisdiction in cases involving capital offenses and felonies, land disputes, contested probates of wills, and civil disputes with an amount over $5,000. And they also hear appeals from district court. So if you had a district court trial on a misdemeanor case and you're appealing that ruling, that appeal would start in circuit court.
Gotcha. So it's like stuff that gets a little bit bigger.
It gets a little bit bigger in circuit court. There's also a family court division of circuit court that hears cases involving child welfare, custody, divorce, child support, and juvenile status offenses. Do you know what a status offense is?
No.
Okay.
Man, now that we're talking about judicial stuff, we're in your wheelhouse. Right. I have no clue what's going
on. So a status offense is a juvenile offense. It is not criminal. It is kind of quasi-criminal. A status offense is a habitual truancy, a child who is not going to school as the law permits. Beyond control, a child who is alleged to have been beyond control of their parents. Runaways, a child who has ran away from their home for more than 3 days at a time. So those are more family court issues. They aren't criminal because they aren't breaking, you know, a criminal statute, but they are some kind of family court issue where they're usually beyond control of a parent,
right,
or something like
that.
So
it's called a status offense because it's not technically criminal, but like it's just one of those things that's bad.
Right.
Yeah.
And those can result in not typically jail time, but maybe a child being removed from the home.
Gotcha.
And being taken into state custody or placed in foster care or something like that.
So that's something I see also a lot on yard signs for people running for judges, is like for family court judge. Those are right. All circuit courts.
Yes.
Okay.
Family court is a division of circuit court, and some circuits have their own family court judges like we do in Jefferson County. We have 13 circuit court judges, and then we also have 10 family court judges. Other counties, sometimes the circuit court judge also hears the family court stuff.
Right.
Smaller counties may have one circuit judge who hears all of those cases. So there's 57 circuits, and some are just a single county. So Jefferson County is its own, But then there are other counties who have up to judges that do up to four counties. So gotcha. People are traveling to other counties to, mm-hmm. to go to circuit court. And circuit court judges have 8-year terms, so double yeah. the length of a district court judge.
Gotcha.
If a case is heard in circuit court and that case gets appealed, then they're in the court of appeals. So that is our intermediate appellate court. So they hear appeals from circuit court, except in a few instances, which I will later explain. So there are 14 Kentucky Court of Appeals judges. They serve 8-year terms from 7 different districts. So even though there are 14 of them, all 14 judges don't hear one case together.
Right. It's not like the appeals court in the United States appellate court.
It's not like the Supreme Court where there's the 9 of them.
Right.
They are on 3-judge panels typically. So not every judge hears every case. And they rotate those panels so that there aren't like the 3 same judges hearing all the same cases together. So they rotate those panels. They have headquarters in Frankfort. But those panels will meet and hear cases all over the state.
Gotcha. So I know that I voted for district court, and I know that I voted for circuit court, and I know I voted for Supreme Court, which we'll get to. I don't know if I've ever voted for appeals court. Are those also?
They're 8-year terms as well.
Okay.
You probably have.
Okay, I probably
before,
you're right. I probably did.
It may have been a while. I don't know.
I might have forgot.
Yeah.
And here's the problem.
And so finally, Kentucky's highest court is the Supreme Court of Kentucky, but it wasn't always the highest court. It was created by a constitutional amendment in 1975. So it used to be that. So for cases, you have like a case citation, mm-hmm. and it used to be that if it was a Kentucky Court of Appeals case. Before 1975, that was the highest court, but now it is the intermediate court, and we now have the Supreme Court of Kentucky. They hear criminal appeals involving a sentence of death, life imprisonment, or imprisonment of 20 years or more directly. So that's the instance where it doesn't go to the Court of Appeals. It goes automatically to the Supreme Court, and then all other cases are heard on a discretionary basis.
Right. And I mean, a lot of the times the Supreme Court of the United States has to deal with a lot of like constitutional issues to determine.
Right.
But that probably isn't as much of an issue because you can appeal to, you know, a constitutional argument to federal court, right? Isn't that kind
yes.
of how
if
that
there's
works?
A federal question involved, that case can also start in federal district court.
So the Supreme Court of Kentucky isn't necessarily like asking questions, these big weird constitutional questions. They're mostly like directly appealing people who are like sentenced to death.
Yes, but they're also answering constitutional questions of law and civil cases. So, you know, the Supreme Court is about to hear oral arguments this week. I think they're in session today actually on a few cases, and you know, one of them is a contract issue. One of them is an issue about sovereign immunity when it comes to counties paying for people that are incarcerated. So there's so many different issues that they can hear cases on. And actually, this was going to be a segment called Checking In on the Supreme Court, but the cases were so boring that I couldn't do it.
Well, we looked at them and they were boring. They
right.
were boring.
It was contract disputes, some land disputes. And so, you know, the Supreme Court of Kentucky can hear those kind of cases on a discretionary basis. And then they also hear appeals on death sentences, life imprisonment, or 20 years or more.
All right.
And so there are 7 districts for the Supreme Court, and those are staggered terms. And those 7 districts line up with this. They're the same 7 districts for the Court of Appeals judges as well. And those are also 8-year terms.
Gotcha.
A fun fact, there is a UC Davis Law Review article that studied state Supreme Courts, and they found that of all the state Supreme Courts in the U.S., the decisions of Kentucky Supreme Court were the least followed by other states' appellate courts. So we have not created a lot of jurisprudence in Kentucky, and we are apparently not followed often by other state appellate courts.
Step your game up, Supreme Court justices.
Right. But, you know, we weren't created until 1975, so maybe they just haven't had time to produce a lot of jurisprudence. But right. according to that article, we are the least followed Supreme Court.
All right. So we have the Supreme Court of the United States, right? That's called SCOTUS.
Yes.
Can we call the Supreme Court of Kentucky Skokie?
I've never heard it called that before. You put that in the notes and I went with it.
All right.
So
we're going to start it. Skokie. It's starting here. Supreme Court of Kentucky.
Right. So that, you know, that's kind of the state judicial system. Obviously in Jefferson County, we have a lot of judges,
mm-hmm.
a lot of district court judges, and then, you know, the 23 circuit judges. But in other counties, they may only have one circuit court judge. They might only have juvenile court once a month. We have it every single day, you know, morning, afternoon. So it differs county to county. But that's the state system. I didn't include anything about the Kentucky federal court, so maybe we can talk about that in another episode. Sure. But there we go.
But we got, so we got circuit.
District.
We got district first, which is all the stuff. Circuit, uh-huh. That's stuff that's a little bigger. We've got appellate, that's
Kentucky Court of Appeals.
Right, and then we have the Supreme Court.
Skokie.
And then Skokie, yes. And we have elected judges, and ask your lawyer friends who to vote for. All right, that sounds like the judicial branch to me. Jasmine, we have one other segment that I wanted to talk about, which I've termed Better Know Your Governor. So this is a story that's a couple weeks old, and to be perfectly honest with you, when it came out, it sounded really stupid to me. But as time has gone along, I have decided it's something that's worth paying attention to. Okay, so here's the setup here. So Governor Bevin, Matt Bevin, he's notorious for keeping his affairs very private. Starting with Paul Patton, so that's two governors ago, or three if you include Governor Bevin. And that wasn't that long ago, that's the 90s. The governors have always released their tax return as they're running for governor. But Matt Bevin refused to do so as a candidate and has continued to refuse to do so as governor. And this was one of the reasons people pointed to him as like a precursor to Donald Trump, because Donald Trump famously has not released his tax releases, but neither has our governor. But of course, Governor Bevin's privacy and his assistance on a higher level of privacy than other governors doesn't stop there. Okay, so this is kind of the story. At the end of March, Tom Loftus of the Courier-Journal, he uncovered that a home in Anchorage, Kentucky, which is in eastern Jefferson County, was being guarded by Governor Bevin's security detail. You should go read the whole piece, but at the end of the day, it appears like an LLC that was owned by a man named Neil Ramsey was the previous owner, and that LLC sold the home to a different LLC called Anchorage Place. The home was sold for $1.6 million, which is kind of surprising because the fact of the matter is that the current PVA records the value of that property at about $3 million.
Okay, so yeah. Bevin's security detail just like standing outside this house, standing guard. Mm-hmm. Is that what we're talking about?
It looks here? And so that would indicate that he's inside the house. Living there.
It might, yes.
Yes. So and this house was sold for about half price, based on what the PVA has assessed it for. So, like, when I first read this story, it's like, Governor Bevin moves to a home in Anchorage, something sketchy, and I'm like, who cares where the governor's living? This isn't a big deal. Like, why are we making such a big deal about it?
It's the something sketchy part.
But the sketchy part is that Neil Ramsey was appointed to the Kentucky Retirement System Board. So, we've talked about the Kentucky Retirement System Board before.
We have.
As one that was dissolved and reappointed by Governor Bevin. And Neil Ramsey was one of the people that was reappointed by Governor Bevin. And then this house gets sold for half the price of, you know, what it was supposed to be sold for. So that's the piece that's sketchy. That's one of the reasons I was like, this does make sense as a story. No wonder this is being talked about. But, you know, obviously the governor does not agree with us here. So Governor Bevin, he went on to Terry Miner's show on 840 WHAS. And he said that Tom Loftus, quote, literally needed to get a life. he said that, and you know what? We quoted him there because on the show he said, and you can quote me on that. So there you go.
He told us we could do it.
He told us we could, so here we are doing it. And then he followed that up by saying, quote, it's hard to imagine. There is literally nothing better for people to do. Bevin had spent a long segment on this earlier on his show talking about corruption and rooting out corruption and finding corruption, he said, on both sides. But, you know, this seems like something like if you're spending part of your show that's like, we got to get rid of the corruption, and then you're like making fun of the media being like, there's something afoot here. And then you're just like,
right,
this is ridiculous.
And I feel like this is kind of his response every time he gets criticized. When it came out that U of L was facing accreditation issues, Bevin was like, it's not my fault. You people get a life. I'm not involved in this. It wasn't me.
Yeah. Then the accreditation agency was like, no, literally you're the only
right,
problem.
Like you, right.
Exactly. Yeah. And, yeah. It's one thing, like stuff like this happens. And if you're the governor, you face a higher degree of scrutiny. And sometimes it's not absolutely necessary. But at the same time, when stuff seems a little weird, you owe it to the people to have an explanation, especially if you're going to talk about corruption in the same very breath. Okay, Jasmine. So the only place where the governor of Kentucky is required to release any of his or her financial dealings is in an annual statement to the Executive Branch Ethics Commission, which usually happens around tax time. So it's around tax time, and Governor Bevin released his disclosure last week. This disclosure revealed that the governor owned 12 properties worth at least $10,000, but these documents are only up to date until the end of 2016.
So that means we don't know about this new one.
But we will next year.
Right.
So we will have
keep
to
keep up with us. We'll for have 2018 to, when we find out about the Anchorage place.
Right. So we'll have to wait until next year whether or not he actually owns the Anchorage property. But it does appear so because the security detail is, and he basically alluded that he owned it on Terry Miner's radio show. So another thing that happened this week is the governor said that he was starting a transparency website to help the government become more transparent to help root out corruption.
Oh, okay.
So the media has been having a little bit of fun today. Be like, I wonder if land deals in Anchorage are going to appear on this transparency website. Bet not. All right, Jasmine, here's my question for you. Given all of this situation, do you think that anything is going to come of this, or do you think that anything is worthwhile to talk about here? Is this something that could potentially be a campaign issue when he's up for re-election next time, or how do you think this all plays out?
I don't think anything will come of it, at least in the immediate future. I do think surely it would be something that would come up during his campaign for re-election. Will it be a big issue that voters really care about? I don't know.
Yeah, it's just kind of wild to me that it's just such a clear line. Like Neil Ramsey appointed to KRS board. Neil Ramsey sells house for half price to Governor Bevin.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not that difficult a line to connect. It seems something very straightforward, but, you know, we'll see what happens. All right, Jasmine, before we go, are you ready for some quick hits?
Go for it, Robert.
All right, quick hit number one. Bardstown Mayor John Royalty was indeed removed from office on Thursday on a unanimous vote. So it looks like what happened was he was snooping around on a councilwoman's iPad without her consent.
There's a little more to it than that, right? Didn't he have someone kind of hack into everyone's email?
I think they proved it about one person. But okay. Yeah, and they didn't release too much information, but they did unanimously remove him from his office.
And apparently, haven't they had mayors removed before?
Yeah, Bardstown's kind of a weird place, but yes, they have had mayors removed before. And yeah, we talked about it before, but you know, we figured we'd follow up with it. So, okay, next quick hit, Jasmine. Third District U.S. Congressman John Yarmuth, he is going to run for a sixth term. Yarmuth is he's the ranking member on the Budget Committee, which is kind of a big deal. That's like a very important committee I feel like it's less important now than it was probably 15 to 20 years ago, but it's still a very important committee. That's the one that kind of sets the budget for the entire United States, ostensibly. Are you excited about John Yarmuth running for another term?
I am. I like John Yarmuth.
Yeah, me too. I kind of wonder if he, once he does retire, if Republicans will bother to field a decent candidate. I mean, Ann Northrup held the seat for three terms for six years. So, you know, Louisville has had a Republican represented before. But I don't know. We'll see what happens. But we won't next time because, you know, John Yarmuth is an undefeatable force in Louisville politics. Okay, and the last quick hit. Speaker Jeff Hoover has set up a new adoption work group. We talked about adoption and this kind of issue a couple of shows ago. It's going to be co-chaired by Representative David Mead, who's from Stanford and is a Republican, and Representative Joni Jenkins. Remember that name, Jasmine. Joni Jenkins. See, she's a representative from Southwest Louisville. It includes some of the most liberal and most conservative members of the legislature. So we'll see what happens.
Right. I'm really interested to see what happens with this because, like I talked about on our foster care and adoption show, everyone wants to reform it, but nobody knows what they want to do.
Right.
And so I am excited to see what this adoption work group does.
Yeah, it ends up that this is going to be a fairly relatively diverse committee, people of color, women, Republicans and Democrats all coming together. We'll see what this group comes up with. It has a good chance to be a bipartisan group that comes up with some interesting solutions to what I think everybody agrees is a, you know, unideal system in the state of Kentucky. All right, Jasmine, well, that's it for this week. How can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @myoldkypod. They can also like our Facebook page. We post our show notes on Medium, and you can listen to our podcast on any podcasting app of your choice.
All right. Thanks, everybody, and we will see you next week.